The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Charles Arthur, and this week around the heart-shaped desk, and it really is heart-shaped, this is not a drill, we have
Samuel Gibbs
and Alex Hearn.
And we also have a very special guest, which is Mike Cole, which will be appearing as Barry White. So, coming up,
my family weren't exactly technophobes, but I didn't get access to anything like a home computer until I was like 10, which is quite late for somebody of my generation, which is kind of first generation computer.
Guardian Games editor Keith Stewart meets legendary games critic turned comic book writer Kieran Gillen to discuss the art of critiquing video games. And we'll be discussing the ongoing disruptions to thousands of websites and services caused by the Heartbleed security bug in OpenSSL. Yes, it's the bug that keeps on bugging. The Xpocalypse is upon us as Microsoft ends its support for the XP version of Windows, and Amazon announces its latest purchase, digital comics firm Comixology. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, it would be fair to say that up until a week ago, most of us wouldn't have paid much mind to OpenSSL. We couldn't have identified it, we wouldn't have known it if we passed it in the street, and we certainly wouldn't have been able to code it. But since the security bug named Heartbleed was revealed by researchers from Codenomicon and Google, who discovered it independently, it feels as though OpenSSL is all that we can think about. The Mumsnet website announced that it thought that it had been the target of a breach via Heartbleed when its chief executive, Justine Roberts, said that her details have been used to post on the website without her knowledge. The Canadian tax authorities pulled the access via their website because they were worried that people's passwords and usernames could be pulled from it without their knowledge. And a huge range of mainstream sites, ranging from Yahoo to Tumblr to all sorts, have been scrambling to deal with a security breach that might have happened, might not have happened, might still happen, and which everyone is unsure whether it's really important or not. So, Alex, you've been writing a lot of the stories on this. Let's start with an overview of what it actually entails.
It's one of those things which is just interesting enough and just simple enough that it's actually worth going into the nitty-gritty of what this is. SSL is the technology which secures almost everything important and confidential on the internet. It lets you send credit cards to someone and not worry that the information that you're sending over Wi-Fi is being read by other people on the network. It lets you securely log in without usernames and passwords being stolen. It secures email as well. It's not just the internet. The problem is, this technology, which was supposed to make the internet all wonderful and secure, is actually at the heart of something which is breaking websites. It's far, far worse than if the SSL was never turned on at all. The problem isn't just that you thought you were sending your credit card details securely and they might have been read. It's that this SSL technology was actually spewing out information like usernames, passwords, and personal data.
So was it actually spewing this out all the time, or was it only if you were very clever, had spotted the weakness, and were exploiting it?
So you had to spot the weakness and you had to exploit it, but exploiting it was incredibly easy.
How is the weakness exploited? Just give us because why is it called Heartbleed?
So it all comes down to this little thing in SSL called Heartbeat, which is designed to let you keep open a secure connection. Essentially, your computer goes ping and the secure server responds with pong. But what actually happens is your computer sends a word, say giraffe, and it sends the length of that word. Giraffe. This word is 6 characters.
No, it's not. It's 7.
Giraffe. This word is 7 characters. And the server responds. It goes, okay, I need to look for the 7 character word that I've just saved in my memory. Ah, giraffe. And it sends it back. What the exploit involves doing, and it's alarmingly simple, is sending the word giraffe and then telling the server that it's 64,000 characters long. The server responds. And it says, I need to find the word giraffe, which is 64,000 characters long. Takes the word giraffe that is saved in its memory and just adds everything after that. It could be anything. It can be where it's also storing usernames and passwords from other people logging at the same time. It can be where it's storing cookies that it's served up, which is persistent data that is stored on your browser so that sites know that you're the same person you were last time.
So how did the CodeNobican guys discover it and the Google people? I mean, were they doing a sort of formal review of OpenSSL? Why did this come up?
So yeah, there were two separate security teams who each discovered it at essentially the same time. And they were both just undergoing a deep code review. The CodeNomicon guys were writing an implementation of OpenSSL, this software which contains the flaw, and the Google security researcher was just reviewing the code.
And was this in the very latest version of OpenSSL or an old version? I mean, why, if it's not the very latest version, why should anyone be worried?
So it's actually been there for 2 years. It was introduced into the beta versions back in December 2011, and it's been shipped as part of OpenSSL since March 2012. It's not as much of a problem as it seems, because people are normally very, very slow to update this sort of back-end web gear. There's an element of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, which is why companies like Apple aren't affected. Apple does use OpenSSL, but was just using a version from about 3 years ago. No one had any complaints, so they didn't bother updating it. At the same time, when something's been in the wild for 2 years like this, a large, large number of companies have updated. This is why we see Mumsnet was vulnerable, the Canadian Revenue Agency. Also, massive firms like Yahoo and Google were vulnerable. One of the interesting little quirks here is because a Google security researcher found it, Google fixed it before they publicized it. Google also told some other companies to fix it before they publicized it. And right now it's looking like getting in on that list of companies that Google tells before they make a vulnerability public could be worth quite a lot. Facebook was apparently one of them, and I'd imagine they're very, very glad that they're friendly with Google right now.
So what is the action that you and I should take? There's been lots of back and forth about, oh yes, change your password at once. No, don't change your password. Don't use the company that you used to use. Change that altogether. Just leave the country. What should people actually do? And what are the implications here for open source? Because, you know, this is a big flaw that's existed for a long time in open source. And there was one earlier this year in TLS, which had been around since, I think, 2005.
I mean, as for what people should do, it's tricky. What they shouldn't do is what companies like Tumblr told people to do, which is rush out and change every single password you have straight away. Because the problem is, if a website is affected by Heartbleed and you go and change your password, you're just telling a potential attacker your new password. You're doing absolutely nothing and potentially making it worse, because if you weren't going to log on to that website anyway, the attacker would have no way of stealing your password. So don't go out and spend all day changing passwords. Ideally, what you would do is you would go through all of your websites and use a Heartbleed vulnerability checker to find out whether or not they were still vulnerable to Heartbleed. And if they were or ever had been, you would change your password. But that is also not really feasible for most people for a number of reasons. The best advice is simple. If any service emails you telling you that they are vulnerable to Heartbleed, log on to their site. Don't click a link, because there's been a lot of phishing attempts. Type the site into your URL and change your password there. Affected sites include Flickr, they include Yahoo Mail, they include Mumsnet and the Canadian Revenue Agency. They also include the online magazine service Issue and a personal heartbreak, my Doge wallet, where I keep my Dogecoin securely.
It's a tragedy. What about banks? Is there any vulnerability for banks?
Most banks appear to be using essentially off-the-shelf implementations of OpenSSL that are safe. The only bank that I'd been able to find that had a weakness was Deutsche Bank, whose German consumer portal was affected. But even then, their actual online banking service was made by a third party and was secure.
And finally, on smartphones, I mean, I've actually just been looking into this myself. As I understand, the iPhone and Windows Phone are not vulnerable. Google said that Android is not vulnerable, apart from Android 4.1.1. And some numbers that I actually managed to get with help from the analytics company Chitika suggest that about 4% of smartphones in the US are running 4.1.1, which translates to about 4 million phones or so, which might not sound a lot, but it might be a fair number. Alex, how would a smartphone be exploited?
Well, smartphones are miniature computers. The ways they would be exploited are if you are a malicious server, you may try and pass an SSL query back to the smartphone in a way that will get it to respond with a Heartbleed bug and spew out the contents of the internal memory. Or if you manage to find out the IP address of a particular phone that you're trying to target, again, you can start sending specific SSL requests to it. It's probably less risky than having a server, because smartphones, by and large, aren't sitting there waiting for incoming data requests. But it's still something that ought to be patched as soon as possible on Google's part.
Yeah, it's a bit difficult, as I understand it, because the 4.1.1 update was in July 2012, which is outside Google's 18-month window, where it says handsets are traditionally updated. I love the use of traditionally there. But anyway, so we move from the cutting edge of security to the blunt edge of Windows, and how quickly the sound of the future turns into the sound of the past. Yes, the chimes of Microsoft's Windows XP, which when launched in October 2001 was universally hated. People just didn't like it. It wasn't 3.1, it wasn't Windows 98, and although it wasn't Windows Millennium Edition, which everyone also detested, it still didn't seem as nice as the old ones. But after time, people came to universally love it. But this week marked the end of Microsoft's support for the system, and so a thorny problem for many people. Sam, how many people does it present a thorny problem for?
Many, many people. And in fact, this is one of the problems with Windows XP. Microsoft has not been able to convince people to upgrade. So we're currently looking at around 430 million PCs globally still running some sort of version of XP. And you can see why people haven't upgraded. The follow-on from XP was Vista. And if you think people hated XP, Vista was absolute dog. And then Microsoft then released Windows 7, which was a lot better and probably what Vista should have been. But it's been hard to convince people to shift. And they've got the legacy problem.
Because you had sort of 8-year gap between Windows 7 and XP, which is...
Yeah, you certainly did. During that time, lots and lots of PCs were sold with a license for Windows 7, but actually downgraded to XP. So the PCs still running XP are not necessarily the PCs bought with XP in the first place when it was being the primary OS shipped. Now, those PCs, the ones that did ship originally with XP just after 2001, those are probably not the issue, because those computers are so old, it's unlikely that they're A, still running. What else runs 13 years after you bought it, apart from Windows XP in a car, maybe?
Mo Farah?
But it's those that are in the middle ground, the ones that shipped when they could have had Vista or Windows 7 but have XP now. Those basically make up a proportion of the global market share, which is about 27% as per net market share. For comparison, 48% for Windows 7. So, you know, Windows 7 is making ground there. Similar facts and figures from companies StatCounter also put XP in the second rung behind Windows 7. So as a user base of the Microsoft Windows PCs out there, XP is still pretty dominant just after Windows 7.
So what's the problem with people running Windows XP? I mean, is Microsoft just annoyed because it's not getting license sales? Are the PC companies annoyed because they're not getting people buying a new shiny PC with all sorts of twiddly knobs on? Or is it actually a bit like Heartbleed? Is this a security story?
It depends who you ask. Actually, for the most part, it's a security story. From Microsoft's perspective, all those computers running XP were a massive burden on it, because it continually had to update them with software patches, security, you know, patching things like Heartbleed.
Microsoft would never be seen dead using open.
Of course not, because open source obviously leaves you vulnerable, maybe. From Microsoft's perspective, it ended support. And that ended in April, and that was that's the biggest issue. And what that really means, it doesn't mean Windows XP suddenly explodes. Your computer doesn't automatically shut down. Microsoft disowns you. What it really means is when it is vulnerable, when somebody finds a hole in it, Microsoft is not going to help you out.
Except it is, isn't it? There are a number of governments which are paying money, good money, our money, in the case of the UK government, to get access to security fixes.
Yes, absolutely. The Crown Commercial Service managed to negotiate a year extension for support, just for the public sector, not for consumers, at the cost of £5.5 million. Now, its big claim to fame was that was a saving from the £20 million that it was likely to have spent if the individual government departments had negotiated their own deal. Still, £5.5 million spent.
It is marvellous just having this conversation immediately off the back of us worrying about Google, whether or not it will update something that is 18 months old. Like, it throws into contrast the actual massive pressure put on Microsoft. It's having to support something which is far, far outside any reasonable standard of what a technology company should be doing. It's not, this is not a company which shipped something in 2001 and said, don't worry, we will guarantee to look after this for 25 years and then backed out. This is years. I mean, If it had an Apple upgrade cycle of every 18 months, this is a full decade beyond when Apple would start phasing it out.
It's true. If it was 2001, then you'd be sort of looking at macOS 10 version 10.0 or 10.1, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
And there's not many machines around running that.
Yeah, Apple just drops the knife after about two or three macOS versions. It's like, oh, what? Right now, and it really is, you're still running Snow Leopard. You mean you can't have the App Store or any of our current software? Yeah, no, deal with it. Upgrade. Yeah. It's not our problem.
But that's Microsoft's both strength and problem. It's Microsoft has for a long time been about legacy. Your programs from 98, Windows 98, more or less could run on XP, and your programs bought for a Windows XP more or less could run on later versions. We're now starting to get into differential territory with Windows 8. Not everything runs on Windows 8, but more or less, programs bought within the last 10 years will run on Windows 7, for instance. And so that is their strength, but also their weakness. And I mean, it's important to note that Microsoft is not dumping XP entirely. It will support malware scanning updates for its Microsoft Security Essentials application all the way through till July 2015. But that doesn't protect you about the vulnerabilities in the underlying operating system.
Should we, Alex, feel aggrieved at governments, particularly the UK government, since it's our money, not having done the updates to XP, given that it's not as if it was a secret or anything?
7 years notice they gave.
Yeah,
them.
That's right. I mean, there's 800,000 PCs of which in the NHS, of which 85% apparently are running XP. Should we actually be on the government's case a bit more to notice that these things are happening?
I mean, it's a really difficult question. There is obviously an element of short-termism in here. The reason why the government is paying £5.5 million to continue the support of XP is because obviously it would cost a lot more for them to just upgrade all the computers to the latest model.
But
they're going to have to do that eventually, so surely they should do it now rather than later. But then the thing is, it's the problem that desktop manufacturers are having everywhere. It's not just in big business, it's not just in the government. Computers that were built in 2001 are pretty good for doing stuff. This is the thing. If you're running simple office software, if you're doing emails and web browsing, apart from the fact that you need to repeatedly upgrade against worse and worse security vulnerabilities, there's not a huge amount of impetus for upgrades. There is really a strong business case to be made for a company to come out and say, yo, this operating system will run on decade-old hardware. We are promising to support it for 50 years. We're not going to support your hardware if that starts breaking, deal with it. But we're at least going to, you know, patch this for 50 years. You'll upgrade when eventually there is some use case that you need. But the idea that software which fundamentally works on hardware which fundamentally works should stop working is an odd quirk of the technology sector.
Fascinating. So Windows XP, it sort of lives on in its zombie state. Thanks, Alex and Samuel. Now, Amazon has been on a tear recently, acquiring companies left, right, centre and top and bottom, for all we know. On Thursday night, the company announced its latest purchase, digital comics firm Comixology. Reaction among the comics community was, well, mixed. Some were cautiously optimistic of the injection of more money and business acumen to an industry which is hanging by a thread in the face of digital upheaval. Others expressed disappointment at the colonisation by the Seattle-based giant of a medium which retains a fiercely independent streak, despite the fact that DC and Marvel, the big two, are owned by Time Warner and Disney, respectively. Alex, tell us about Comixology, and should we be upset or should we be rejoicing?
My initial reaction was yelling to the high heavens that nothing good can ever stay independent in this world. There is a certain amount of bleakness that I find in just everything good and wonderful in this world will eventually be owned by Apple, Microsoft, Google, or Facebook, or Amazon. Comixology is, in its own odd little way, the Amazon of its sector. It's by far the market leader in digital comics. It's done that through aggressively making deals, through strong mastership of its technology, but also actually through doing what some people accuse Amazon of doing, of driving down the price of digital comics with its... It offers weekly sales, which sell single issues at just 99 cents.
And so these are digitalised comics of what? These wouldn't be the DC and Marvels.
DC and Marvels. No, Comixology has signed deals with every single major publisher except Dark Horse, which is most famous for publishing Buffy comics, Star Wars comics, and the Hellboy series. Apart from that, DC and Marvel, it has Image Comics, who are probably the third biggest publisher. It has Boom Studios. It has 76 smaller publishers, and it has a huge creator self-published initiative. Almost every single comic which is released onto the direct market, single-issue floppy comics, is sold through Comixology.
How big a market is this, then? I mean, in terms of value, in terms of number?
It's tricky. I mean, so the comics market, these days, the best-selling comic every month will hit around six figures in America.
Digital?
This is paper.
Right.
The digital market, no one is releasing hard figures on this. The whole thing is guesswork. It's still smaller than the print market. That much seems obvious, if nothing else, by the fact that you can look at how the publishers treat digital comics, and they are, for now, very much second string. They don't want to cannibalise their print market to move in digital. It's a story we've heard before in every other sector.
Is the problem that it's so hard to protect a digital comic
No. Comixology has very, very strong... it has digital rights management, but more than that, it's entirely app-based. Online, it's HTML5 comics. They don't sell you files. They sell you the ability to read your comics through the browser through their apps. So there's not the problem there. The thing for the publishers is that comic shops have historically been how publishers get new readers. Comic shops are an incredibly valuable one-to-many sales mechanism. Someone comes in wanting to buy Spider-Man. A good comic shop will then turn around and go, hey, you know, you like this book, you might like these, you might like these. If you want to know the backstory of this character, there's this. This same author also writes independent. And soon enough, you're me and you're spending £100 a month on comics. The thing is, 100,000 comics sold, 100,000 issues of Batman sold every month is minuscule compared to previous peaks. You know, you don't even have to go back to the 1940s when tens of millions of copies of the biggest issue were sold. Even in the 1980s and 1990s, comics were a bigger business than they are now. And that is after the success of the Batman movies, that is after the success of Marvel's The Avengers, that is after the success of The Watchmen. None of these things have really fed back into the comics market. So the hope on the part of all of these publishers is that a company like Comixology can come along and make buying comics accessible to children who aren't in the market. It can make buying comics accessible to people who've always been a bit curious but never jumped into it, and could grow it back up to those 1940s levels.
So, Sam, is this Amazon looking to, rather as it's doing with ebooks, looking to corner a market in an electronic format?
I mean, Amazon's tried this before. It does sell comics separate from Comixology. In my experience, it's not particularly great at handling them. It made exclusive deals that ran out, and it sells comics generally for more money than competing services. But then, of course, you get the benefit of being able to read them through the Kindle app on basically everything. That experience is not fantastic. So I think what Amazon's bought here is both bought brand. The Comixology brand is quite good. If you search for comics, you get Comixology. It's bought technology because the Comixology app is really good. And from my personal experience, it is something that's dragged me into reading comics. I've never read comics in the paper form, but I do now read comics in the digital form because it's such a pleasing experience on a tablet or a smartphone. It's really fantastic. And so that that double team there, I think, was almost irresistible for somebody who's trying to dominate the kind of digital media market. And you can see that in other Amazon moves. It recently merged its Love Film in the UK with its Amazon Prime Video, and it's now pushing that really hard in the UK, as it did in the US, and it's kind of becoming one giant media company, making its own pilots for TV shows and making its own moves and exclusive content. And now that's moving into comics.
It is also worth pointing out just that this isn't simply Amazon buying technology and Amazon buying a brand. The Comics by Comixology app is the top grossing book app in the App Store, in Apple's App Store. Marvel Comics and DC Comics, which are both white label branded versions of the Comixology app, are the second and third top grossing apps in the book section of the iPhone App Store. There is money moving around here. And to a certain extent, now that Amazon's bought Comixology, its aims are in tune with Marvel and DC. They all have quite a large business interest in growing this medium.
Terrific. Alex and Sam, thank you very much. A decade ago, a plucky games writer called Kieran Gillen penned a manifesto for all those journalists writing about computer games. It was a call to arms and a declaration that computer games and computer games criticism was coming of age. Since then, Gillen has gone on to have a diverse career writing about computer games, music, and most recently as a comic book writer for the celebrated Marvel Comics. See, it's all tied together. We're not just doing this stuff randomly, you know. Guardian Games editor Keith Stewart met up with Kieran to discuss the anniversary of his new games journalism manifesto and his work as a writer in comics.
Kieran, Marvel writer, games writer, tell us a little bit about what you've done so far.
Well, my biggest achievement today is actually getting out of bed before noon, which was very exciting.
For a writer, that's quite an achievement.
It was a big thing. I didn't get dressed until about half one, when I actually had to run to get to the train to be here. And those are my main achievements at the moment.
Okay.
I kind of was this, to go really geeky, basically dual-classed. I did my first game journalism in 1995, when a guy came up to me in a club and asked me, do you want to write about games? Which is how it was done back then, it seemed. And I worked full-time in magazines like PC Gamer and went freelance, and which basically gave me more free rein to mouth off a bit more. And I became mildly infamous for writing something about called the New Games Journalism, which is anniversary time. And then I kind of got into comics and I found myself doing small press, which led to bigger projects and indie works. And kind of like by the end of the decade, like I started reading comics properly around 2000. And by 2010, I'm writing four for Marvel. And that's kind of where I'm at the moment. So I do my own comics, like The Wiccan Divine, coming out in June, and Phonogram, and works for like Avatar, which are very, very dark World War II stories called Uber. And I do my stuff for Marvel, presently writing Iron Man and Wolverine Origins 2. Name a Marvel superhero, and I've probably written it by now.
Let's talk about games and how you start. I mean, did you start off as a gamer then, or a writer, do you think? What was your first kind of... Did you come into games through your love of writing, or were you always a gamer?
I was actually a professional writer before I realised I could be a writer. It's like my family weren't exactly technophobes, but I didn't get access to anything like a home computer until I was like 10, which is quite late for somebody of my generation, which is kind of first generation computer. And that was a Commodore 16, which doesn't really count. And then next year we got Spectrum, and that's a Spectrum in 86 then. That's like 6 years into the Spectrum thing, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But before that, it was arcades and my friends' computers and all this kind of like just the incredible excitement and the potentiality of it, which is kind of what always attracted me to it. At the same time, I've always written. And eventually the two kind of crossed. It's like when I discovered games magazines, like I was 11 then, I think, and it was the primary one was Your Sinclair. This is like Duncan MacDonald period. And that was kind of like the first time I'd really understood contemporary writing that talked about my life and said things I could never possibly say about it, because I haven't got the framework to think like that, and was blisteringly painfully funny. I mean, I can quote huge chunks of Duncan MacDonald reviews even now. So they kind of merged together, and that's kind of like me, my love of criticism and my love of writing generally, and they kind of just merged a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting you say that, you know, going back to Your Sinclair, and that was saying things about your life, when people think about video games, and I think this is something we're probably going to touch on again and again in this chat, but people think of games as being something quite throwaway and quite surface and superficial. But I really do think that we are, me and you are probably the first generation where we were reading things like Yul Sinclair and Zap 64 and Crash, and we were seeing in them the same kind of things as maybe a generation before us saw in NME and Melody Maker, that sense of seeing ourselves represented.
Absolutely, that is without a doubt. And the special, the British critics, I'm using the word critic, which is great. I know almost all the writers of that generation wants to punch me for using the word critic, I'm sure. Because bless them, they're not nearly as pretentious as we are. But they all, the British press, they kind of come from music press backgrounds. As in, at least they read the music press, they're aware of the idea of this being very furbile, youth-orientated, very idea-led writing. You know, they all read their Nick Kent or whatever. You know, and Yul Sinclair was explicitly trying to rip off smash hits and do it for games. As opposed to, say, the American tradition, which generally comes from the tech writing tradition, which is much more drier. So the fact that it depends what parts of the toolset we saw in the art, you know, in sort of in the criticism we read growing up, in the magazines we read. And there was a general sense of, A, it could be fun to read about it, because it's interesting. I mean, there's a reason we sit in the pubs and talk about this crap. You know, it's fundamentally meaningful and interesting. Yeah. And if there's a reason why we like it. I mean, you know, talk about ephemeral and throwaway, but most things are. So it's like, you know, I have a great faith in your own instincts and what you like. Even if you can't express it, there's a reason why this mood does stuff to you. And there's a reason why you're drawn to this art, and whether it's music or comics or whatever.
Our game critics at that station that cinema writers were maybe in the 1930s or something, where the medium that they're writing about is so young, we can't take on the idea of, as a culture of real criticism. So, you know, is there a Lester Bangs? Is there like a Pauline Kael who popularised cinema criticism in the 1970s and turned into something intellectual? Is kind of culture and society ready for that games version of that?
I'm actually paraphrasing an argument by Paul Barnett here, but he kind of definitely thinks the idea of people writing about pop disposable culture, which is generally disrespected, they find their own individual Lester Bangs. You know, and you've been Lester Bangs to someone, I've been a Lester Bangs to someone. I know that because they've told, you know, not as many words because they've never read Lester Bangs. But they've got, you know, I've had people walk at you with the voice of your generation, mate. And I was like, yeah, are you sure? It's a very small part of the generation. And basically, it's you, isn't it? You know, that's what Bangs only really is respected in retrospect and by people who loved him and people who love music. Yeah. And essentially, as the cultural dominance of that form rose, Lester Bangs' critical ship has rose. And, you know, he ends up in songs and whatever. You know, see what I'm saying? So
yeah,
I think we are pretty... I think the problem is games is a disreputable art form. And I don't think it's necessarily because it's young anymore. I think it's more like pop, because pop music was around for a long time, and the pop music critics, how respected are they even now? You know, and even people I love, like, I know, Paul Morley, love watching him on television, but he's still someone who people kind of raise an eyebrow at.
Maybe we should move on to comics then, and we should talk about... I mean, you said you worked on small press and projects before Phonogram, but Phonogram, I guess, is that your first kind of major... work, even though it wasn't on the scale of Marvel, and it seems to me, and I don't know if this is true, and I've tried to find interviews with you about this, but I mean, it seems kind of obviously semi-autobiographical. Is that true or not?
I wouldn't say semi-autobiographical.
It's just you. Could you explain it for anyone that hasn't read it, and they ought to have?
Phonogram, in terms of like my want to a better word, career. Phonogram is basically my cool indie film. You know, if I'm, it's my pie or whatever. It's that kind of black and white indie film which got quite good reviews and did some business and certainly got me on enough people's radars to open doors, which is nice. Phonogram is basically an urban fantasy comic. It's based around the concepts of music being magic in a very literal one-for-one sense. When I say music being magic, I don't mean like Harry Potter or Fireballs or Dungeons and Dragons. I mean... a specific example of how music is used and abused and by people. I mean, the example I always use is a story in the second volume, The Singles Club, that came out in 2008, which is the very short version of a guy who walks into a nightclub, a record plays, and he's suddenly confronted by an apparition of an ex, and the ex forces him to relive a series of really painful memories. Effectively, he's been cursed by the record. And that's, you know, me talking about, we've all got records which we hear and they're like daggers through our chests. And not all the stories that emo, but, you know, as a general trend, that's what we do and that's what Phonogram's about. And, of course, it hasn't really got... The first volume is a lead character called David Cole, and Cole is a demi-autobiographical portrait of pretty much my worst features. Like, Cole's an awful, awful human being. So it's kind of like... It's a dialogue about myself as a writer and all those kind of things. So, yeah. And it's about the fact that I'm talking... And that's, it's kind of part of the, it's a major part of the project in that by basing it so tightly on essentially things I've experienced or people I have been or friends I've loved and lost and all that kind of stuff, I'm not just, and most importantly, bands which are real.
Yeah.
I'm not saying music is magic in some kind of abstract kind of like airy-fairy way. I'm saying, no, this happens to people every day and my life is genuinely transformed by art. That's kind of, Phonogram, a lot of Phonogram fans are really big music heads, obviously, but that's kind of, there are people who are like very interested in comics or even games or whatever, and they recognise the nature of the obsession of the characters and how art has transformed them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, you know, as evidenced by me doing all the criticism I ever have, I'm somebody who has a pretty intense relationship with the art I used to think about myself. And most, we all are, really. That's a kind of, that's the basic what Phonogram is about.
Yeah. And what I loved about Phonogram was that the music, it wasn't just that you use real bands, and it wasn't even that you use contemporary bands, but you use kind of Britpop bands, which gave it a place and a time, and it was reasonably controversial that you used these bands. You didn't, I guess you could have done that comic and found really super obscure bands. You could have gone through Melody Maker or whatever, and but you went for bands like Echo Belly and well, maybe not Echo Belly. I don't have, picking Britpop bands off the top of my head.
Rue Britannia was basically specifically that volume, because we've done two volume and third volume coming out hopefully towards the end of this year. The first volume, called Rue Britannia, is kind of about nostalgia and history, and pretty much somebody who has always, you know, I said earlier, I'm a neophile, somebody who has always hated the concept of being stuck in the past, suddenly realizing that you're exactly the same as everybody else. So I used Britpop because that was a very important period for me. What's a good way of putting it? It's not a very complimentary book towards Britpop.
No.
It's pretty much saying, if you think this music is now awful, and most of it I do, why do you care anyway? And Rue Britannia finds an answer to the question. You know, and the thing me and Jamie always say is that
Jamie's the artist.
So Jamie McKelvey, being my partner in crime, and lover, that if someone ever was mad enough to try to make a film with this, you know, they would completely do a high fidelity with it. They would take it to America in Seattle, and they would base it on grunge. They would set it 10 years after grunge, and the same, and the full story beat for beat. And which we say that's a joke, but the truth is that that would work. You know, you could do this with any musical movement or scene and take the 10-year gap and show how culture then reimagines and reappropriates and how that feels. And that's kind of like with Phonogram, we use specific to talk about the universals. That's the kind of, we get hyper-specific to make it not airy-fairy, as in here is a case study. However, if you're willing to go with this case study, it applies older. It's like I said earlier, the Curse song thing. Mm. And we use, actually, it's CSS. But it could be anything, you know, because the entire point being that could be any record.
Yeah.
And the second volume is kind of, the first one was very, obviously very Britpop-centric, and the second one set in 2006 in a single nightclub with seven stories intertwining, and that was a bit more musically diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one's mainly about 80s pop videos. It's called Immaterial Girl.
And that's been quite a long time in the making, hasn't it,
the third one? I mean, it's been written for like 2 or 3 years now. It's set in 2009. I think most of it written in maybe 2012, maybe 2011. It's been pushed back repeatedly because we thought we're doing a book called Marvel. So me and Jamie, we're doing a book at Marvel called Young Avengers.
Yeah.
And we're planning to do it at the same time as Phonogram, but in the end, it just wasn't in any way feasible. And then we thought about, okay, we'll do it after Young Avengers finishes. And Young Avengers is a superhero comic primarily about the concept of the new. And it was kind of anti-retro, and it didn't... There's so much in superhero comics which is backward-looking. And we took a very year zero kind of approach to it. And we tried to imagine if you were recreating how a Marvel comic could feel in 2013, how it could feel. So after that, it kind of felt a bit iffy doing... going back to our own old project. It's like we would almost be betraying it to do that. So we decided to do something else first. So we're doing a book called The Wicked and the Divine, which is about basically... The short one line is gods as pop stars, you know, and that's it. So it's kind of the flip of Phonogram. Phonogram's about being a consumer of art, and this is kind of about being a creator of art, but also fight for a metaphor.
Yeah.
So we're doing like that, and then Phonogram, and then back to Wicked and Divine. So that's okay. Kind of our ongoing plan.
And how did Marvel come up? Because that must have been like a surreal moment for you. Did you see it coming? Was it a surprise? Did you get a call from them?
Yeah. I tell you, the moment you always remember is, of course, the check, because the Marvel checks used to have Spider-Man on. So the first check arrived.
Wow.
It was pretty cool.
Excelsior.
I'm sorry?
Excelsior. Excelsior, yeah.
Yeah, that's Stan Lee's cheer. Marvel, I can't even say this. As a journalist, the Marvel pay better than any company I've ever written journalism for. And I mean that in time, as in they pay phenomenally quickly.
Hmm.
It's nice. Trust me, after years of like chasing people around for 3 months, it's suddenly like very exciting to work with professionals. The Guardian were also very good at paying, by the way.
Yeah,
I stress. It was a weird one, because I never really... I saw myself as kind of the underground indie guy. And like Lost Phonogram was very critically acclaimed, the second volume especially, and got on people's radars. It doesn't really say, yeah, that's the guy who should really be writing Iron Man. It's kind of... it's such a singular statement. I found myself doing some very small work-for-hire things elsewhere. And then Warren Ellis, the comic book writer and general cultural curator and commentator... Thanks, Warren. He basically was doing a series at Marvel called New Universal. And they wanted to do a few spin-offs of the book, like just one-off issues at different periods in time and history. And he pretty much said yes, as long as I get to pick the writers. And Warren basically... And he picked, like, me and two other, like, writers of the period he was into and he thought were interesting and, he thought they could do interesting stuff on a wider stage. And I did this story called 1959, which was a kind of like a James Ellroy superhero kind of, like, story. It was very American tabloid, so it's quite gritty. It's quite gritty for a Marvel comic. And that opened a lot more doors at Marvel, and that came out, and the editor saw it, and it's like, wait. So he's the guy who can actually write a narrative which is about something other than Echabelle B-sides. and that one-off thing led to two offices particularly talking to me at Marvel, and that very rapidly steamrolled. And, of course, being freelance at this point, I had a kind of, like, fluid thing, in that anytime anyone offered me paying comics work, I could put into my normal day, because all my other comic writing I did in the evening, I had a kind of split life. And it definitely got to a point around 2008, I kind of realised I'm earning much more from being a comic creator than I am a journalist. So I mentally switched from being a journalist who occasionally did comics to a comic writer who occasionally did journalism. Mm-hmm. And I carried that on to, like, 2010, but especially the last year or so, I was pretty much only writing for Rock Paper Shock on my own site, and an occasional bit for Eurogamer.
Just finally, I guess, it strikes me that video games now are maybe, you could say in a very simplified way, that they are where comic books were maybe 30 years ago, when we were getting comics like Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns and Alan Moore's stuff, Watchmen and...
Mouse and, basically Love and Rockets, the whole 80s.
Exactly.
Breakthrough.
Yeah, suddenly there was this breakthrough, and suddenly you had weekend colour supplements and newspapers talking about the rise of, they'd probably call them graphic novels, but the rise of comic books. And it seems as though we are maybe at that stage now with video games, in that culture is looking at us and suddenly realising that maybe there is something in The Last of Us or there is something in Gone Home that is saying maybe what Frank Miller and Alan Moore were saying in the 80s. Would you agree? Do you think we are at that kind of stage of cultural acceptance?
I think I think it was a big deal when The Guardian started writing about video games. I said that at the time, a decade ago now, but I still think it's true. And in terms of the amount of cultural understanding or interest in games, the idea of, and some of the games that can be commercial now. Dear Esther was... You can argue over quite a bit, but when DS was released and then sold as many as it did, the idea of a game which is just walking and looking can actually do pretty decent numbers. Spoke to the possibility of the audience and there being an audience for this kind of stuff. That was always the kind of the joys, and there was always kind of like, especially in the noughties, all these sort of art games which weren't for sale. But the idea that no, this can be of sale, this has value, this is something, in the same way I'm willing to pay to go to an art gallery where I don't understand anything and love it, I'm willing to pay for a game for a similar experience.
Kieran Gillen, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Kieran Gillen there, and you can hear a much longer version of that interview posted on our SoundCloud blog. That's soundcloud.com/Guardian Tech Weekly, all one word. Remember, for the best games coverage, just go to theguardian.com/technology. And that's all we have for you today. Thanks to Samuel Gibbs and Alex Hearn, but for me, Charles Arthur, and my co-host, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. See you next week.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.